Welcome to Bookwaves on Cover to Cover. I'm Richard Walensky. My guest is Elizabeth Berg, whose latest novel is Dream When You're Feeling Blue. Other novels include Durable Goods, The Art of Mending, Until the Real Thing Comes Along. There are 15 novels, two nonfiction books, including one about writing. You're primarily known as a writer of women's fiction. Do you feel that constricts you at all?
Absolutely. People want to label things. They want to put you in a box so that they can tell what you are. I understand the inclination, but unfortunately, I think it's a pejorative term. There isn't men's fiction. What does that mean, women's fiction? Does it mean romance or chick lit, or what does that mean? I think the best definition might suggest that what I like to deal with are relationships, primary relationships, and feelings. I don't write thrillers or crime novels. I care deeply about feelings and how people relate to each other.
Before we go into your career, which is fascinating, let's talk a little bit about this particular book, Dream When You're Feeling Blue. It takes place in World War II, but it takes place among the women and some men on the home front, which we read very, very little about. We see a lot of comparisons between what's happening now and what happened then. And I'm just curious, is that where the origin of the book came from, or did it come from some other place?
I did want to write a book that focused on women in the home front. My work always focuses on women. You're right. There are a lot of books about World War II, not so very many about the home front. I wanted to pay tribute to the generation. I am only now beginning to have full appreciation for the kind of generosity, the kind of character that those people exhibited. I think they're called the greatest generation for a reason. And my dad is, whose photograph, incidentally, is in the book in the very first few pages. It's my parents' wedding photo. My mother got on a train and went to Texas and married my dad, much to my grandmother's dismay. It's for him. I wrote it for him. A lot of extraordinary things happened in the writing of this book. You probably know that when these guys came back from World War II, they didn't want to talk about it. They put it behind them and went on to what appeared to be a very bright future. My uncle was on Omaha Beach. I never knew that until I wrote this book, and he had never spoken about it. I asked his daughter if he might be willing to talk. I didn't want to ask him directly because I didn't want him to have to say no. She put me in touch with him. She said, I think he's ready, and indeed he opened up. He still remembers so clearly everything that happened that day.
There's a letter toward the end of the book written by a guy named Michael. Does that come out of your uncle's experiences?
No, I just wrote that. I'll tell you, normally I'm a linear writer. I start at the beginning and I go straight through to the end. With this book, it was a bit of a departure for me. It required an enormous amount of research, which I don't usually do for my books. And I needed to really try to understand what it would be like to be there. So the first thing I did was write that letter, because I wanted to see if I could convince myself anyway that that might be what it was like. Sometimes I read it in readings, and what people say is, did you mean to write an anti-war statement? Which, yes, I did mean to do that. And I think that that letter drives it home, because it's the same. It doesn't matter whether it's a war that took place in 12 BC or the Iraqi war. It's always the same. It's this senseless waste of life. Someone at a reading I did this afternoon said, you need to send this book to our commander guy and tell him to read that letter. And I said, yeah, well, first of all, he'd need to read. And I don't think he's the kind of guy that does. I don't think our commander guy reads.
In reading this, I noticed, and it's come up a few times, is that one of the main differences, aside from all of the other differences between what we're dealing with now and even as opposed to Vietnam, is there's never a word about sacrifice. We don't give up anything. And
right.
Yet these people in World War II, they sacrificed a lot. And it's on every page of Dream mm-hmm. When You're Feeling Blue.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's always there.
Yeah, we talked about similarities, and that's the difference. Because it was, if a war can be good, it was a good war. It was a just war. We were attacked. Almost everybody was behind this war. Almost everybody did something, whether it was baking cakes to bring to USO dances or the metal or the rubber drives or plane spotting or working for the Red Cross. Everybody was behind it. They did without meat and butter and sugar and nylons, and everything was going for the boys, as they were called.
And coffee.
Yeah, can you imagine? Okay, here's what I would do. You got a pound for 5 weeks.
Okay.
I would drink it the first day. That's it, gone.
Let's talk a little bit about research. At the end of the book, you talk about how you spoke with your parents and all your relatives to get as much as you can, and you put us there. But I also know in talking to writers that sometimes they feel that the sense of reality is more important than the actual reality. How do you feel about that?
Everything is so subjective. I don't know how one can ever have a sense of absolute objectivity. You can't. Certainly I did more than just talk to my relatives, because that's a select group. I read lots of books. I read Ernie Pyle, which was fantastic. Because I was focusing on women and families, I looked at women's magazines from the time. I also looked at news magazines and general interest magazines like Life. The Ladies' Home Journal had a column written by Eleanor Roosevelt. I was struck with how much more intelligent the women's magazines were, how they focused on philosophy, the arts, science, politics. Of course, the war was in every magazine. A lot more fiction and good fiction was written in them. They weren't fluff. They weren't telling you how to suck fat off your body or the silly stories that are in today's magazines. It was really interesting.
Some of the areas I'd like to ask you about, let me throw a few out. First, getting the dialogue right. How do you do it? Is it just by watching movies? Because they may or may not be right.
Well, I love the 40s and always have, so I do that with my girlfriends all the time. I use that kind of language. But for this book in particular, I did look in books of slang for the time, and I incorporated a lot of the things that I saw there into the book.
Now you're living in Chicago. You lived most of your life in New England, but now you're in Chicago. Did you talk to people about what it was like in Chicago at that
particular
time?
I did, yes. And Chicago was, well, you know, so many soldiers passed through there. Just jumping with soldiers.
I didn't know about the dances with soldiers. The two main characters, Kitty and Louise, who were sisters in their early 20s, they spend most of the war going to, even though they're engaged, they spend most of the war going to these dances, dancing with soldiers.
One of them's
and,
engaged.
Well, the other one
kind of wants to be.
They and their younger sister go to these dances, dancing with soldiers, and then they write to them. And that was pretty common.
It was very common, yes.
How did you find out about that?
Well, my aunts told me that. It was hard to say no to someone. You knew where they were going. You knew they might never come back. And if they asked for you to write, you just did it.
And they just wrote all of these letters on these special envelopes.
V-mail, yeah. They didn't have V-mail right away, but when they did get it, what they did was photograph the letters and put them on film and ship them that way. So what happened was the letters moved much more quickly. They were shorter, but they got them faster. And mail was so, so important, called 10-minute furloughs.
And the radio shows, you listened to a lot of radio shows for it, I take it, or read books on the radio?
I read books on radio and television and movies.
And the clothing?
Yes, I looked at lots and lots and lots and lots of pictures of clothing from the time.
At a certain point, did you feel overwhelmed with the material that you had gathered?
There was a bit of a sense of feeling overwhelmed. Certainly I had far, 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 far more material than I used. But it was enriching for me, and I hoped to make it enriching for the reader. It's not what I do, as I told you earlier. I don't write historical fiction, and so it was a challenge for me. But I meant to gather the research first and then write the book. But I got so excited when I did the research that the book started creating itself. So I did it simultaneously.
One piece of research that's in the book concerns the character Kitty working at a factory, and this is based on material from the mother of a friend of yours?
Well, it's based on a lot of things I read and documentaries that I watched, but I have learned that my best friend's mother was a Rosie the Riveter, and the way she met her husband is she was working on riveting the nose to a plane, and she would bring her lunch every day. She's Italian. And it would be this big greasy bag with this great stuff inside. Now, I can't name all the things that were in it as my friend can. Just to hear the names of them makes you nuts with desire. So everybody else was eating Spam. So she would auction her lunch off every day because everybody wanted it because it was so good. So that's how she met her husband, because he kept buying her lunches.
When you were working on that section of the book, you put yourself in Kitty's place, I would guess.
Mm-hmm.
Felt how that was like. How did it feel working in a factory with all those men? How did it feel as you were writing it?
One thing I learned, this was a real surprise to me, because I always envisioned the Rosie the Riveter types going in there and being given great respect, everybody glad to see them. In fact, that was not true. They suffered a lot of abuse. There were all kinds of sexual innuendos. People were not all patriotically working on the job. They were sleeping on the job, literally. They were knocking off early. Not many of them, but this was a surprise to me. So I imagined her going. I've worked hard in my life. I would work double shifts as a nurse. I know what it's like to be so achingly tired, but she was even more tired and filthy. When I read how dirty they got, that even though they were wearing shoes and socks, the dirt got between their toes. And they had metal shavings in their hair that they had to rinse out.
And then they'd come home, get ready, and go out for an evening at the USO to
dance.
Meet boys.
Yeah, yeah.
At the core is a relationship between two sisters. You have an older sister.
I have an older sister.
Does this reverberate in a lot of your fiction sisters like that, or just...
But it is not like my relationship with my sister. We were not close, my sister and I, growing up. We've become a lot closer now that we're old hags. But we were not close growing up. She was 5 years older than I. The girls in this book are much closer in age. And they are incredibly close.
Did you kind of envy that?
Yeah. I went there and I lived there the whole time I was writing the book. And I loved being there. I love that family. I'd like to live with that family.
they had a few problems, but they did
well,
pretty well.
Well, you have to.
Yeah. In terms of creating the characters, you said that usually you start at the beginning, move to the ending, meaning that you kind of know where you're going, but the road there follows whatever path this follows.
I don't know where I'm going.
Really?
But I do write in a linear way. I just start at the beginning, and I see where it takes me. Oftentimes, I'll know the kind of ending I'm working toward. I might know a last line. In this book, there's something that occurs that I meant to occur at the end. I didn't know quite who it was going to be or how it was going to happen, but I knew that I wanted that to happen. I was looking at the notion of sacrifice, which you've already mentioned, and I was thinking that it was so prevalent, and this character, Kitty, grows so much because she's really very naive and self-centered when the novel opens, and she grows to have an appreciation for everything that everyone is doing. She has ambivalencies about Julian and even about Hank. This is the guy for her, but she's just not quite sure about this. Oh, am I going to stay home and wear a house dress and not work? She makes her own sacrifice.
When you're creating this and you don't know where it's going,
mm-hmm.
that means that there are always surprises along the way. And in mm-hmm. in a way, characters do things you don't expect.
That's right. And if I'm not interested when I'm writing it, I don't think a reader is going to be interested reading it. I like to be surprised. I like to have this process of discovery every day when I write.
What was the biggest surprise in the early part of the book, at least?
It is such a strange process, writing a book. You're so married to the process. And for me, as a writer, I hand it over to whatever that instinct is. So when we talk about the surprise at the end, that's a big surprise to everyone. But I didn't know that Margaret was going to go to a USO dance. I didn't know that Frank was going to have this talk with his daughter in the basement about the day he brought her home from the hospital. I didn't know any of that. That just emerges in a kind of organic and mysterious way as I'm writing the book.
But you knew that there would be another man for Kitty, the main character, that she wasn't quite getting along with boyfriend at the beginning.
I thought that she was going to just want Julian to propose to her. And then as I was writing and I was thinking, you know what, I don't know about this relationship between Julian and Kitty. And this is what happens. You know, you may think things are going along fine. And the wonderful thing about writing letters is that you reveal a separate part of yourself. And when she begins just writing to Julian, she finds, oddly, that it's very difficult to think of things to say to him. That doesn't happen with this new guy.
And then that develops.
Yeah.
The epilogue takes place in 2006. Did you always intend that?
Mm-hmm. You know why? Because I think we have a tendency when we look at people, I look at you and I see you as you are now, and I don't think about you as a little boy. And we look at old people and we see them as old people. And we disregard their rich, rich past. We have to, because our minds would be too busy otherwise. But I wanted to do that because I wanted to remind myself primarily, and others by extension, of the rich past that that generation in particular has and what they contributed.
I think that the 40-year jump is so sudden and so swift that a part of our minds is seeing them as young and old at the same time, which is an amazing feeling.
Which I wanted, yeah. There have been some very strong responses to the end of that, in a good way, to the poignancy of that. I wept when I wrote that scene, because I know how many of those people are disregarded and how few people are really interested in their stories.
And then to find out that one of the characters had died of breast cancer,
mm-hmm.
which we've all had to deal with mm-hmm. with friends. Or
yeah, I lost a very good friend of breast cancer, yeah.
Elizabeth Berg, let's talk a little about the rest of your career, because this is a good place to go
mm-hmm.
there. You started writing relatively late, and you had a series of jobs. You were a nurse for 10 years.
Mm-hmm.
When you were doing that, did you have any idea you wanted to write?
I always wrote, but I wrote letters, and I wrote in journals. And there was a point at which I had two daughters. I wanted to stay home with them. It was either sell Tupperware or try writing. And I knew I'd be a lousy salesperson. So I had been told by teachers and friends, you should be a writer, you should be a writer. And I was completely naive. I knew nothing. I knew nobody. And that was probably a good thing, because I was not put off by how difficult it is, how few people are able to make a living writing, and so on and so on. So I just sent in essays to magazines, and I was really lucky. I got published right away, and I got published frequently. And I wrote for magazines for 10 years, and then I began writing short stories for magazines, and then
it started
novels.
With Parents Magazine.
Mm-hmm.
Is that the first one you sent in?
Yeah, when I decided, okay, today I'm going to be a writer. I went down to the drugstore and I bought a bunch of magazines I thought I might be able to write for. My daughters were then 4 and 9. I thought, well, I can write about them. So I bought Parents Magazine. I bought all the women's magazines. And they were having an essay contest that month, Parents, which I entered and won. And I started writing for Parents. I ended up having a column for both Parents Magazine and a magazine called New Woman, which no longer exists. And then I just wrote essays for the New York Times Hers column. Remember that? National Geographic Traveler and virtually every woman's magazine on the market.
You're listening to an interview with Elizabeth Berg, whose latest book is Dream When You're Feeling Blue. At what point did you decide, okay, now it's time to write a novel? And that first novel was Durable Goods.
Right. It happened organically again. I never thought I'd write fiction. I was happy writing essays. I was doing pretty well writing essays. But I just began to get interested in writing fiction. I wanted to just try it. So I started, as I said, with short stories, and I was in a writer's group at that time. And I would bring my stories, and it felt very odd to have them read that and act as though these characters were real people. It felt like I was going to get in trouble because I was lying about all this stuff. But then it began to get comfortable, and I had a few stories published. And then I wrote, actually, there's a scene in Durable Goods where the narrator, who's a 12-year-old army brat, is talking about how it feels to move all the time and not be allowed to cry when you leave the old place behind. I meant to write it as an essay, but it was so rich with feeling. I knew that I had the germ of something much bigger here, and I knew that that was going to be the first novel.
And you were an army brat moving
mm-hmm.
around a lot.
Mm-hmm.
So this character, at least at the beginning, took off from your own autobiography.
Mm-hmm. Yep. We lived at an Army base called Fort Hood, Texas. I wrote about an Army base in Texas, and I remember frying eggs on the sidewalk. I remember walking to the pool, and we would have contests to see who could walk on the asphalt the longest without burning their feet off. All that stuff is in there.
First novels for a lot of people, Elizabeth Berg, is when they get that stuff out there. Mm-hmm. And then comes the real problem. Okay, you've written the book you were always meant to write, in quotes. Then what do you do? So what did you do at that point?
I love writing. I don't suffer from, quote, writer's block. If ever I have a time when I really don't feel like writing, I don't write. I feel like if you're a writer, you're born with a certain sensibility and you are always working because you're always noticing. In fact, that's what makes writers such dismal dining partners, because they're always looking around at everybody else, you know, kind of mentally taking notes. I write quickly. I write often. I finish one thing and I start the next. So before Durable Goods was published, I was on to the next one. To me, it was an extended essay. Okay, what, that's done. Now let's. I need to be writing. I have to. So I find something to write about.
There's a sequel to that called Joy School, actually two sequels to it eventually. The third is true to form, but that was fairly late that you decided to go back to the same character. What happened?
I was taking a bath, and she popped into my head, and I was thinking about junior high. I was in the hallway of a junior high in my bathtub, and I was thinking about how difficult it is, and I thought about her being in a new school, and I started seeing the teachers, and I started getting all kinds of ideas, so I jumped out of the bathtub and went down the hall and started writing Joy School.
Did True to Form come in right after that? Or
no.
No, there was a
write. I thought I was done with that character, and I was doing a reading for another book, and one of the people said, are you ever going to write about Katie Nash again? And I said, no. And she said, well, you have to. I have to know what becomes of her. So I said, okay. I don't know. A couple of years later, I'd finished a book, and I thought, well, what is that girl up to? So I wrote a third one, and that one, I think, was the last one, because readers know what she will become, what will become of her. But a lot of people ask about that character and ask for yet another book, and I have to say she's one of my favorite characters, too.
Before we started, I asked you whether these people in Dream When You're Feeling Blue are related to those, and you said no.
Mm-hmm.
Do you ever cross-pollinate your characters in your book?
Yeah, I have. I put a character from one book in another book. Oh, it's just something that you do for fun once in a while. I think it's actually kind of annoying. You go to a reading and someone will say, I noticed you put the guy from Until the Real Thing Comes Along in The Pole of the Moon. And then you say, oh, you're really careful. Read, it's just a little game. I just did it a couple times.
Well, a lot of your past shows up in various ways in your books. Range of Motion is about a coma victim, and that's based on your work as a nurse, correct?
Yes. I took care of a lot of people in comas when I was a nurse, and I always wondered, what might the thought process be like, if you could even call it that, of someone who's in a coma? That's why I wrote that book. I thought, I want to try this. I want to try to write from the point of view of someone in a coma, which I can tell you is a challenge. I also knew that I wanted to write about hope and resiliency and advocacy and love and family. And yeah, it was a lot of things, but it came, yes, from taking care of those people.
When you finish a book like that, which is almost an experiment,
mm-hmm.
How do you feel? Do you feel relieved that it's over? Do you hit yourself and say, I could have done it better? Do you just put it out of your mind?
I think almost any writer would tell you that he or she feels like smacking themselves in the head when they read a finished book and think, oh, I should have put this in there. Oh, that sentence is wrong. Or, oh, no, I repeated cat in three lines. You can edit yourself into your grave. But I am finished with a book when I have this internal clunk. It's like putting a car into park. It's done. I'm just not going to mess with it anymore. And the only book I have never had reservations about is Durable Goods. When I got Durable Goods back in galley form, I lay on the sofa and read it, and I thought to myself, dang, that's a good book. And I never felt that way again.
Really? Let's get back to this for a second to Range of Motion, because that one is such an unusual idea. You say there's a certain point when you know it's done. Had you been rewriting it? Do you do much work on cleaning it up once the first run-through is there, or is it pretty much done?
I am the kind of writer who writes best in a fever and when I leave myself alone. That's not to say I don't edit, because of course I edit. But my process is that I write for the day. I'll write about 4 hours or so. Then I'll put it away, and then I won't read it until the next day when I edit it. Same thing the next day until I'm done with the book. Then I read the whole manuscript again and edit it. Then I send it in. Then my agent and my editor give me their comments, and I go through it once more, and then it goes to the copy editor, and then you know about them, and that's a whole other thing.
The reason I ask that is because a lot of writers will get through that first draft almost as quickly as in a fever dream, and then after that, then comes the hard work, maybe more fun even, of just changing word after word after word. And
right.
It sounds like you don't really do that quite to that degree.
I don't do it to the extent that a lot of writers do. I don't throw out 80 pages. I'm a pretty spare writer. I don't have a whole lot of excess. Of course I do change things, but I don't throw out whole sections or rewrite the book or throw away a book. There was one book that I kept on my shelf. I just didn't like it that much. I had another idea. And that book turned out to be the Oprah book. when I brought it back out and rewrote it, that was the Oprah pick.
Which
open
one was
house.
That?
Open
oh,
house.
Open house.
Yeah.
You also wrote something called a book called Until the Real Thing Comes Along, which is about a woman's relationship with a gay man. And this is based on you had a boyfriend who later came out, is that right?
That's right. I never intended to write about it. I'm not sure what it is that made me... Oh, yes, I remember what made me come up with that idea. The focus was on women who have this extreme longing for babies. They just are desperate to have children. And I had a friend who was that way. And I was thinking, what must that be like? To just want so much for it to happen, and it doesn't happen. And what would prevent a woman from being able to realize that dream? Well, one thing might be if she's in love with a gay man. So I thought of my good old gay boyfriend with whom I stayed friends. Unfortunately, he died of AIDS, but I stayed friends with him for many years, and he was so elegant and so generous and so handsome and so kind and so funny and so supportive. And so the character of Ethan was modeled after him.
You also did a book called Talk Before Sleep about a woman with breast cancer and her friend.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess that's your own feelings.
Friend. Yeah. Yeah, and I never intended to write about that. After the experience was over of caring for her at her time of dying, I realized that it was far more positive than negative, and I wanted to write a tribute to female friendship. If you can die a death like she did, surrounded by people who love you so much, and if you can express such love and receive such love and be so honest, it's pretty wonderful. Naturally, everybody wanted her to stay around longer. She was only 44. But she went out with such style and grace, and I remember being in her apartment she had a disparate group of friends. I remember being there with all of them, and we had a picnic on the floor, and we were laughing so hard, and I was thinking, this is so odd that we're just having such a bang-up time here. That book has really struck a chord with so many people. A lot of people who are living with breast cancer use it. One woman who died asked to be buried with it because she considered it a kind of friend. I'm gratified by that.
According to one of your biographies, you once given a diagnosis that you were going to die of cancer in 5 years. Is that correct?
Yeah. I have an indolent lymphoma. I was diagnosed 20 years ago. And when I was first diagnosed, I was a nurse, and I did my own research about this. But before I did, I told my doctor to tell me straight. I said, so what's... Tell me, you know, don't fool around. And he said 5 years. And I said, uh-oh, I was 35. Then I went to the medical library and I did my own research. And I found out that the mean time of survival was 20 years. And I said, so what are you telling me? And he said, well, you have your statistics and I have mine. So I changed doctors, found a guy that, you know, I could relate to. And
So it's been in remission for 20 years now?
Crops up every now and then, but I used a topical chemotherapy at first, and now it's treated with topical steroids, and it doesn't appear that it's going to be doing much of anything. What it was the big tap on the shoulder. I will say that it affected my life in a very profound way and continues to. But so did being a nurse. When you understand how brief this all is and how arbitrary.
Well, when you say it affected you in a profound way, did it change how you dealt with other people and how you dealt with your life? Is that what the writing was about? Or?
In many respects. Sometimes if a writer is prolific, there is a negative reaction. There is a thought that if you're writing this many books, you can't be any good. There's that. There can be some jealousy about it. One of the reasons I'm so prolific is I didn't know how much time I had. I had a lot to do. And also, I happen to be a very fast writer, and I love to write, so I'm writing all the time. But, yeah, I had a mission.
Well, Anthony Burgess, I think, was diagnosed in the early 60s with a brain tumor and given like a month to live, and he began writing feverishly, and about five or six books later or something, 4 or 5 years later, he suddenly said, "Wait a second, I'm alive."
Yeah.
But, you know, I guess it kind of prods you to do your best work, or could prod you that way if you take it in that
I think so, too. Yeah, you get really focused.
Do you think any of that affects the writing of books like Dream When You're Feeling Blue, because there's a part of you that had to deal with death absolutely directly in the same way that the characters in this book do?
Absolutely. Even as being a nurse makes its way into every book I write, the kind of things I learned about people. If you want to be a writer, go to nursing school.
Elizabeth Berg, films. There was supposed to have been a film of Cost of Living with Goldie Hawn, was there?
It was. It's very confusing. I change my titles a lot. Until the Real Thing Comes Along was at one point called The Cost of Living.
Okay.
Goldie Hawn wanted to option it, and that deal did not happen, as it turned out. It's now been optioned by Working Title Films for television. This book is being looked at, Dream When You're Feeling Blue is being looked at. Someone wants to option it for television. And We Are All Welcome Here has just been optioned by independent producers for feature film. So those are on the stove.
But you haven't had anything as yet.
Yeah, three.
Oh, you have?
Uh-huh. Open House was a CBS movie. Range of Motion was a Lifetime movie. And I wrote a book called Say When, from a man's point of view, about a divorce that became a movie called, unfortunately, A Very Married Christmas.
How do you feel about these things when they come out? Are you able to divorce yourself sufficiently and say, well, you know, my book is my book and this movie is whatever the heck this is?
In some respects. I think that Open House was a pretty good movie. Range of Motion was okay. A Very Married Christmas was less successful. When you write a book, you imagine characters a certain way. You hear them speaking in a certain way, so that whether it's a tape that you hear with people saying it not quite the way you imagined it, or a movie that you watch with people doing it not quite the way you imagined it, it's a little uncomfortable, but I do know that that it's a whole separate art form. You can't take a book and translate it directly to film. When people try, when they try to be too true to the book, I think the film suffers.
Sometimes.
So, yeah.
I can give you an example where it never did. I
mean, what?
The best example of translation was Maltese Falcon, which is virtually identical to the book.
Yeah, but for the most part, I'm thinking a more recent film is The Namesake, a brilliant book. I loved that book, and I liked the movie, but I think the movie suffered from trying to be too true to the book. But to answer your question, you have to hand it over. They're very nice. They fly you in. You get the flowers and the chocolates, and you go out to dinner. You meet the cast. Ha ha, very nice to meet you, celebrity. And it's nice. It's nice. And I have had the privilege of seeing scripts. Would I write it that way? No. I wouldn't do the dialogue that way. But sometimes I see an actor deliver a line that I saw in the script that I thought was ridiculous, And because of their acting ability, it's okay. Other times, I think, I wish I wouldn't have put that line in there.
Have you ever thought of working on a screenplay of one of your own books?
I did a screenplay. I worked with Sharon Stone, actually, and did a screenplay of a book called Never Change. She wanted me to try writing it, and we met, and we worked together for, I don't know, 3 days, 4 days. She's so pretty. It's not currently optioned, but I did write one.
When you look at your entire career, do you see any overarching themes that you can pick out yourself?
Yeah, I guess for me, I want to say that the ordinary is extraordinary. I say that over and over again, that it's always the little things. And that's a lesson I learned at bedsides from people who were seriously ill and were not missing their fancy car so much as their cracked yellow cup that they drank coffee from every morning. Their relationships are extremely important and grow more so as we grow older.
When you're looking at a book like Dream When You're Feeling Blue, which is of a piece, do you ever think you could pull it apart and reuse some of the characters elsewhere?
Yes, you could. I am always interested, with the exception of the Katie Nash character, in going on to explore a new character or a new idea. But, of course, you could take Frank and Margaret Heaney and write about them as younger people. And I get a lot of requests, as I'm sure all authors do, to bring back, could you write a sequel to this book? Write some more about this character. But, again, I'm usually eager to go on to the next thing.
I want to ask you about a book which is kind of outside of that realm, two books. One is a novel called The Handmaid and the Carpenter, mm-hmm. and what prompted that book, and the other is your writing book.
The Handmaid and the Carpenter, I tell people it's like When Harry Met Sally, but it's about when Mary met Joseph, and it was written because my editor had said, you should do a Christmas book. And I thought, oh, please. You know, all I could think of is the guy hates Christmas, and then a little miracle happens, and then he loves Christmas. And the very idea bored me to death. So, but then I thought, wait a minute. How come nobody's written about what started this holiday in the first place? What must it have been like to be a 13-year-old girl giving birth to this guy that everybody was getting all excited about? And more interesting to me was, what was it like to be Joseph and have this woman tell you this? The book is really about faith in any age, about any issue, about what makes us make the leap to have the faith. A lot of people had a problem with The Handmaid and the Carpenter. It was a departure for me, for one thing. You asked early on in the interview about being called a women's fiction writer. And people want to pigeonhole you, and they also don't want you to go too far away with what they become familiar with. So The Handmaid and the Carpenter was historical fiction, really quite different from anything I'd done before, written in a particular style. It was meant absolutely to be in very simple language. Some people thought it was blasphemous because, you know, Joseph has certain feelings toward his wife. I thought it was actually quite lovely, but it was interesting.
Elizabeth Berg, your nonfiction book, Escaping into the Open, The Art of Writing True, this comes from someone who never took writing classes, has been in a writing group, and has pretty much said that you're kind of a born writer.
It came about because, if you've been to readings, you know that inevitably people ask about a writer's process, and they have all kinds of questions about writing. So I wanted to have one place where I put everything I knew and believed about writing, and I also put a whole bunch of exercises in there, little homework assignments. It's meant to act as a kind of cheerleader, to just be there and make you feel like, listen, you know, have fun. Open your heart and your soul. Write it out. You don't have to show anybody anything until you're ready. Relax. Have a good time. Don't write "the cat came in" and then say, should I say "this cat came in"? Should I say "the kitten came in"? Came, had come in. People do that. They write one sentence and they overanalyze it. So I wanted to let people have fun, and then I put recipes in for some more fun.
Any success stories? Anybody come to you and
yes,
say, you know, I've written a book and it's been published?
Look on Amazon. There's a guy in there that's more than one person has said that they used the exercises. No, not a book yet, but people working on books, people who got short stories published, people who felt like for the first time they could relax and have fun and use it all the time. Very gratifying writing that experience. Plus, people love the chocolate cake.
There's a chocolate cake recipe in there.
Yeah.
Elizabeth Berg, okay, you've written this book about World War II, Dream When You're Feeling Blue. And this book was finished, I guess, probably close to a year ago or something like
right.
that. That means you probably finished one since.
I'm in the process of finishing one, yeah. It's short stories. I did one collection of short stories, and this is a second. All of which have to do with women and food. The title is The Day I Ate Whatever I Wanted.
Have you begun working on another novel?
Yes, I know what I'm going to do next. I know who the people are. I know what the circumstance is that will start the novel. I know the issues I want to look at in writing it. And I think I know the title. I think the title will be Times Like This, but that's all I know.
You say you know what issues you want to look at. And I talk to writers all the time, and they say, I'm exploring an issue.
Mm-hmm.
What does that mean to you?
I think that it's true of many writers that we don't know what we think until we write it, that's how we actualize the world, is to write about it. You let your subconscious speak when you write. And there's a lot of wisdom in the subconscious that never makes it up to the brain. When you write, you discover truths that you didn't know were there. You discover beliefs that you didn't know you had. You come to resolutions that you couldn't formulate without writing about it.
In a book like Dream When You're Feeling Blue, what did you learn in that sense then?
I, again, came to such rich appreciation for that generation, and I believe I wrote a tribute to them, which is what I wanted to do. That was definitely one of the goals. The other thing, as I said before, too, was to write an anti-war statement. And people are struck with the parallels between this war that we're experiencing now and that.
You've been listening to an interview with Elizabeth Berg, whose latest novel is Dream When You're Feeling Blue. I'm Richard Walensky on Cover to Cover.